I said this yesterday, it is true again today. The big picture economic story this week, once again, is jobs, jobs, jobs. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the second day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The story about jobs in this economy has been, for weeks, certainly maybe a month or two, it's been the story of companies getting desperate to find people and workers in no hurry at all to go back to jobs that maybe have not great working conditions and definitely not great pay. The Conference Board said today about 80% of companies looking to hire mostly industry and manual services workers are having a tough time finding them. 25 states, all of them led by Republican governors, are trying to push people back into the workforce by cutting unemployment benefits and, increasingly, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, by making people prove they are actively looking for work.
In many ways, this is just going back to the way things were pre-pandemic. States suspended requiring people to look for jobs to get benefits when there weren't really any jobs, and people were supposed to be staying at home. But now that employers are struggling to fill positions, those rules are kicking back in.
This is mostly related, I would say, to people who are being called back by their former employer.
Andrew Stettner is a senior fellow at the Century Foundation.
In those situations, you know, you generally, if you're on unemployment benefits, you do have to go back to that former employer or else you lose your benefits.
But a lot of people may not want to go back to their old jobs or even the industry they worked in before. Kate Bonn is director of labor market policy at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. She says these requirements
may make businesses be able to hire workers, particularly in the short term, but I don't think it encourages sustainable quality job matches, even for those businesses.
Because, she says, those workers probably won't stay very long in jobs they were kind of forced to take. But the job search requirement is politically pretty popular, has bipartisan support, and many businesses looking to hire are demanding it. Catherine Edwards is an economist for the Rand Corporation.
Employers have a understandably single-minded view of success in this situation. They want to hire someone at the wage that they're willing to pay.
But she says it's better for workers and the economy for people to spend a bit more time on unemployment so they can land a better job down the road. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Once people get those jobs or the jobs they have get back closer to normal, there is some, well, friction, you might say, between workers and the bosses about the office, specifically being in it. Some companies would like to have people back there. Some people would rather not. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
If you go onto job site ZipRecruiter, about half of people looking for work say they want to work remote right now.
And almost half say that they would like a remote job even after the pandemic is over.
Julia Pollack is a labor economist with ZipRecruiter, which, by the way, is a current Marketplace underwriter. Now, that's what job seekers want. What they are being offered is something else.
Only about 9 or 10% of job postings explicitly offer the opportunity to work remotely.
Now, that's a big increase from before the pandemic, when only 2% of job postings offered remote work as an option, but still.
There's a big mismatch between what job seekers are looking for and what's really available.
But a lot of employees are not playing around when they say they want a remote option. Barbara Holland is with the Society for Human Resource Management. They surveyed workers back in February.
One third of the respondents had said that they were willing to take a pay cut in order to continue working remotely.
And given employers have been screaming about a labor shortage,
I think it's going to shift our job market.
Some companies stand to gain. Dan Scott is a legal recruiter with Engott Search Group. He says about 40% of his clients, mid-sized law firms, are open to remote work.
I am able to bring better people to those firms. It's just the reality because they're looking at the best people. They're not looking at the best people in their market.
The reality right now is less a war between employers and employees and more just a lot of experimenting, according to Robert Sutton, an organizational psychologist at Stanford.
We're going to see what works, and we're going to make a lot of little mistakes so we don't make big mistakes.
And of course, this is all connected to the tightness of the labor market. When unemployment benefits run out and kids go back to school, the conversation over remote work may look very different. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The May unemployment report comes out Friday morning, by the way. That is why we're on jobs so hard this week. You heard about the ransomware attack on the world's biggest meat producer, I'm sure, JBS. The company does say production is mostly getting back online today. But if you needed evidence, a cyber attack is coming soon to a company near you. There is this. The Massachusetts Steamship Authority said today it has been hit in a ransomware attack. Ferries are still running. Should you be traveling between Woods Hole, Martha's Vineyard, and Nantucket, cash only, though, the company says, and you should probably expect some delays. On landlocked Wall Street, today mostly status quo. We'll have, don't quibble, by the way, on landlocked Wall Street. Just don't. Details, numbers, you know the drill. You're going to need way more than the fingers on one hand to count up the various shortages in this economy. Truck drivers, talked about that one yesterday. Containers to move all the stuff we're buying on those trucks. And then there's all the stuff that goes into the stuff that goes into those containers. Semiconductors and lumber, aluminum, steel, the list goes on and on. All those shortages trickle down to the people trying to get stuff they make into consumers' hands. India Hines runs a company called Vinotemp. It makes refrigerated wine cabinets, and it imports ice makers and dishwashers and other appliances as well. So we got her on the phone the other day to talk supply chain.
We cannot get container space on the vessels. Also, there is a chip shortage, so products are delayed. And we're constantly getting price increases every day. It's a different problem.
Well, so there. Let's unpack that a little bit, and let's start at the beginning, right? Containers coming out of, I'm assuming China is where they're coming from.
Correct.
How do you get container space at a time when pretty much everybody on the planet is screaming for container space?
Well, I don't. I think that's the big problem right now. So, for example, last year we paid something like $3,500 a container. Now we're looking at $10,000 a container. Ooh. And we are told if we pay a surplus, a $1,500, $2,000 surplus, we can get some space. So basically, we'd be taking the space of someone else. So of course, I look at that as a shakedown, and then I get really mad. I'm like, I'm not paying that. So the two companies that are getting space right now, so I hear, are Amazon and Walmart. And I'm a little guy.
Size matters.
So, right? You know, yeah. I'm last in line.
Okay. So that's, well, right. Look, I feel your pain. Okay. So that's containers. Talk to me about chips and semiconductors and specifically, you know, we've all heard about cars and all those things that have, you know, a dozen or two chips in them. How many chips do your appliances need? And is it, this is a strong word, but existential problem for you? Because this chip shortage is going to be around for a while.
So when I first heard it, I was like, I kind of thought, oh, it's just a moment,
yeah.
Not like the freight problem, which is really, really a problem. So far, there is a delay on a few models, but my product's already delayed.
Yeah.
So I think I'll know more the extent of this pain in about 4 months.
That's not a short amount of time, 4 months to be operating.
But the cycle.
Yeah.
Right. But the cycle of products now, where it used to be, you order something, you get something in 60 days, basically.
Yeah.
Now you're looking, I mean, I get emails saying, order now, because it's going to take 6 months to get your products. I'm like, 6 months.
Right.
So it's really difficult to try and provide proper inventory with this chain disruption.
Right. Let's get to the third item. Price. This is costing you money. Yeah, this is costing you money, I'm sure. To what extent can you pass that on, or are you eating it, or what the what?
Okay, so we sell to like the top retailers.
Yep.
And the struggle we're having, first you get pushback. First you're like, what? Price increase? No one else is doing it. Okay, right. then you're like, I don't have a choice. I have to pass it. Or there's just no point in selling the product if, you know, if we're breaking even or losing money. So it's just kind of at that point where we raise it as much as we can. Problem is that they already raised it in November. Then we got the last month or so saying raw materials, everything's really expensive. Copper's expensive, blah, 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 blah. Of course, you know, I'm pushing back, delaying, pulling the trigger on some of these orders until I'm just really trying to negotiate better pricing because I can't go back to my retailers. They take 60 to 90 days to increase their pricing. So it's really on nuts on the supply chain right now.
So look, what are you going to do?
Well, I've had to stop a lot of products that I wanted to test. I've had to put every new kind of item on hold and just really focus on what I know sells.
Yeah.
Luckily for me, products that we were testing and that we might have stock of all are selling through. Yeah. So it's actually almost like a spring cleaning, which is, that's the positive part for me. So I'm not crying yet. I'm not happy with the product stuck. I need it. But all in all, we've managed this whole thing pretty well.
India Hines, her company is called Venotemp. She's trying to manage through this pandemic. Ms. Hines, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Moving to an entirely different kind of supply chain, the supply of new workers graduating from colleges and universities, and work with me on the metaphor there, will you? Commencement season is well underway, and there have been more in-person ceremonies this year than last, but plenty of virtual ones, too. Derek Lindstrom is one of the 10 people we've been following in our series about the American labor force. It's called The United States of Work. And he is the dean of the School of Liberal Arts and Cultures at Minneapolis Community and Technical College. He sent us an update.
So we just wrapped up spring semester. We had over 1,000 graduates, another virtual graduation. There was a point where we didn't think that we'd ever get through this academic year. There's been a lot of work faculty have done to weather the pandemic and support students. And so hopefully they're enjoying a nice breather right now. I'm staring at spreadsheets like I always do. So not much change here. Enrollment for summer is down a percentage point or two, which is the first time it's been down in our summer for a couple of years now. Prior to the pandemic, our average student age was 28, and we've seen it reduce. So we're getting younger students. And so I don't know if that's a reflection of older students delaying their educational choices until they can be in person. And so, you know, right now it's kind of a guessing game. And with the CDC changing guidelines on masking and social distancing, we're awaiting more direction from the Minnesota Department of Health on what that will play out. But I would guess by July, we'll have a better idea of demand of where students want to be and might have to shift at that time. I'm still at home. I'll start transitioning back to campus on a rotational basis over the summer and then more fully in the fall semester. I'm an introvert, but I had to be on campus for an event a couple weeks ago, a community unity event, and I ran into a faculty member who has an office like two doors down from mine, and we sort of walked to the office together. And that was like one of the things I'm like, oh, wow, I hadn't thought about how sort of valuable and important those hallway conversations are. Not to mention it saved me like 9 other emails in the process.
Derek Lindstrom there at Minneapolis Community and Technical College. He's part of our series, The United States of Work. Coming up.
I was like, this isn't adding up.
You know, sometimes it never does. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 25 points today, just under a 10th percent, 34,600. The NASDAQ up 19 points, 10th percent, 13,756. S&P 500 found 6 points, also about a 10%, 42.8. $200 billion is the number we are looking at today. How much corporations have committed to racial equity and social justice since May of 2020? That's the calculation from the McKinsey Institute for Black Economic Mobility, which says much of that money is aimed at affordable housing and support of small and medium-sized businesses. Sabrina was telling us about employees who prefer to work remotely, even in a post-pandemic world. A lot of companies that outfit offices are catering to the work-from-home customer. ODP Corporation, they own Offices Depot and Max, up 0.5%. Herman Miller, he of the chairs, down 0.7%. HP Inc., down 0.2%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We talked work and the changes coming to it as we got going today. And while there is still a whole lot we don't know about what work is going to be like in the long term, I will bet you a paycheck there's going to be a bunch of video conferencing involved. And as the risks from the virus fade, we're probably not all going to throw out our ring lights all of a sudden. But how we use video technology is probably going to change. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Much like that 50-pound sack of flour you bought at the beginning of lockdown, video conferencing has gotten kind of stale over the last 14 months.
I'm on Zoom from about 8 a.m. in the morning, sometimes until 7 or 8 p.m. at night. I felt like I was living in a screen.
Kyle Arteaga runs a PR firm that used to have offices in San Francisco, Nashville, and D.C. He's mostly gotten rid of them and transformed into a remote-first workplace he hopes will rely a little less on video conferencing soon.
We're just going to have to make rules and set parameters over when it makes sense.
The technology is going from a substitute for social interactions to just a tool, says Eric Gordon, a business professor at the University of Michigan.
I think we all learned something about the value of physical presence. People who irritated me in my office, I can't wait to see them again.
But it doesn't have to replace face-to-face to be useful, says Siddhal Neely, a business professor at Harvard.
It's additive, it's complement, even for people who might be co-located. There's convenience to say, hey, let's get on Zoom for 15 minutes and figure something out.
Video chatting has become a reflex we won't just drop, but we'll use it more sparingly, says Brian Kropp, head of HR research at Gartner.
What are the tasks and activities and moments where we really need you to be in the office, and what are the ones where you don't need to be?
Video works for one-on-one meetings or presentations, but collaboration, new introductions, or sharing a birthday cake, probably better in person. Just don't use that old flour. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Should you miss us on the air for some reason, we've got a podcast, you know. Check it out. No matter how close a relationship is, it can still be incredibly difficult to talk about money. Studies actually show that arguments about money are a top predictor of divorce in this country. And after a divorce, among many other things, it can be tough to be open again with a partner about your finances. It's the kind of thing you don't really know how to prepare for because not a whole lot of people like to talk about it. From our podcast, This is Uncomfortable, Rima Kreis brings us a conversation between a couple that actually likes to talk about money, even if they don't always agree.
The spring of 2013 was one of the most difficult times in Lindsay Galbraith's life. She was pregnant with her second kid, her husband had lost his job, and a storm had just caused a tree to fall on their house. One night, she was busy handling insurance claims and poring over the bills.
And I was looking at, you know, bank statements, and it just, I was like, this isn't adding up.
She asked her husband, why isn't this adding up? He didn't say anything. He left the room and came back with a suitcase full of clothes, fully expecting Lindsay to kick him out for what he was about to tell her.
And he showed me his bank account on his phone, and it was hundreds of dollars in the hole, overdrawn. And he said, I don't have any money.
She caught him in a web of lies. He'd been lying about getting unemployment and also had pretended to be enrolled in school. After 2 years of trying to mend their relationship, Lindsay filed for divorce. Once she started dating again, she vowed to keep her love life and money separate. Eventually, she met a guy named Chris. Their first date was at a cocktail bar. Do you happen to remember what you talked about?
I think one of the things that I really like to talk about is relationships.
Wait, so like, were you talking about your ex-husband or just like conceptually relationships?
I kind of don't think so.
She absolutely did talk about him at length.
That's Chris Johnson, Lindsay's date.
And she was like, ex-husband, a tree fell on my house. Like, it just all came out.
Chris and Lindsay have been together now for 4 years, and they're pretty much on the same page about things, except for when it comes to money. Chris wants to merge their finances, but the thought of that, especially after her divorce, freaks Lindsay out.
I got a sense very early on that some of that came from trauma. She very clearly was going to need time to come around to certain things.
Instead, each month, a chunk of Chris's paycheck automatically gets deposited into Lindsay's bank account, and then she buys the groceries and pays the bills. They're still figuring it out, but they were willing to let me sit down with them and record a conversation about how they manage their finances.
I'm very comfortable with this arrangement. How do you feel about it, Chris?
To some extent, that does feel a bit, like, infantilizing seems a bit too extreme, but it's almost like it's setting up a bit of a dangerous kind of parent-child dynamic, which is like, you know, potentially death for many relationships.
Lindsay admits she likes to be in control, and she worries what could happen if they pool their money.
Like, there will be some situation in which one of us isn't happy with the way the other person is spending money, and it becomes contentious.
So I think that what this comes down to is you are doing more prep for a potential exit strategy than I am. You are being more mindful of, if we break up, do I come out equitably with the amount that I deserve to come out with?
You're right that it is like really about like what happens if we break up.
And so like I am mindful of that, because I just don't think this is about me.
No, it's not about you at all.
Right.
I know that you are very responsible with money and that you are not trying to swindle me in any way.
Like so many people, Lindsay's relationship with money is influenced by her past, and she's trying to protect herself, which can make it hard to compromise. Chris often finds himself doing this delicate dance of being mindful of Lindsay's boundaries while also trying to honor his own needs and how they manage their money. About an hour into their conversation, he makes a pitch for at least a shared account for groceries.
That small extra step adds a level of control for me, or a level of ownership over the process, that makes me feel as if I have some equal level of say.
Okay, we can get a joint bank account for the groceries. That's fine.
I think we should use podcast interviews to mediate all of our financial conversations.
Chris says it's a step forward and, you know, a step away from an exit strategy. I'm Rima Khreis for Marketplace.
You can catch more of the conversation between Chris and Lindsay by following This Is Uncomfortable wherever you get your podcasts. This final note on the way out, which comes as the White House announced a bunch of new ways to get getting vaccinated easier today. Anheuser-Busch said this morning it's going to buy 21 and over America a round of beer once the Biden administration's goal of 70% vaccination is reached. About which, two things. First of all, beer? Question mark from Anheuser-Busch, but maybe that's just me. More to the point, you read the fine print and you see the company is going to get your data, it's going to get your pictures, and oh, by the way, it's really just a $5 virtual debit card to the first 200,000 people who respond. All right, we got to go. Here is your moment of economic context, though, staying consistent with the theme of jobs today. Research out of the New School and economist Teresa Ghilarducci, who we've had on the program, she among others, it shows an extra, that is unexpected, 1.7 million workers over the age of 55 retired because of the pandemic, just retired. In particular, the research shows Black workers without a college degree, which is to say some of the most vulnerable people in this economy. Just retired because they couldn't get jobs. Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufuk Mematolu, Olga Oxman, Erica Phillips, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Star Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.